Good evening all. I'm very glad to be back in the North London Centre. I feel a bit as though I'm in India. I've just given a talk at the London Buddhist Centre in East London and got in a car, come over and back on stage again, which I rather enjoy. Not quite enough people as in India. Dhammashala and I go around India and move from platform to platform. So I'm going to talk to you about a Nidana chain that's found in the Pali Canon that is especially concerned with social strife, how social strife develops. And in the course of going through this Nidana chain, there are a few points about Dhamma that I think are relevant to us as individuals and us as individuals in society, in a collective situation. So in the time that's available, I'll try and draw out something from it. I want to tell you the context in which I re-looked at it. It's a sutta called the Honeyball Sutta, the Mudu Pindala Sutta from Majjhima Nikaya 18, anybody who's interested. I brushed off this sutta, which I hadn't looked at for a long time, when I was recently in Hungary. I've been visiting Hungary to support some mitras of ours, who are mainly from a gypsy community. All of them are from a gypsy community, apart from one. And they're working together to create educational opportunities for gypsy youngsters who basically evade the education system. Partly they evade it because they are, until quite recently, the great majority of gypsy children were declared mentally subnormal and were given separate classes where they were supposed to get special teaching for which money was provided. But of course what it meant was they got less teaching and the money went to the ordinary schools. This is true, it really is like that. It was like that. So a lot of gypsy children just drop out of the school system very early on. There's also, because of the whole history of the gypsies in relation to the wider society, quite a strong sort of sense of alienation and separation. You'll be familiar with it from Romania, similar sort of things there. Very poor relations both ways. And a lot of suspicion from gypsies. I mainly am in contact with gypsies. I don't know so much about how Hungarians view it, the white Hungarians. But to tell you, make the point clear, the gypsies refer to the white people as Hungarians. They don't consider themselves Hungarians. So it's quite a high degree of separation. So our friends from the gypsy community are trying to get young people back into the education system, but they're doing it in a way that's sort of appropriate to them, which means pretty wild, lots of music, and very lively. It's quite difficult teaching, but you know, very, very rewarding. More and more students are coming through with high school leaving certificates, and therefore able to get jobs, because 90% of gypsies in northern Hungary are unemployed. I've been going to Hungary once or twice a year for the last 4 or 5 years, and just trying to keep connection with our friends there, our mitras there, encourage them on. They connect very strongly with our work in India, and they identify themselves with that work. They consider themselves to be in the equivalent position to the Dalits in India. So they identify very strongly with Dr. Ambedkar. When I went this time, we were travelling from Budapest up to the place where our friends work, and there was a phone call from the local police chief who said that there was going to be a political rally in the village where we work. Half the village is gypsy, half non-gypsy. And this political rally was by from our point of view, is a fascist party. It has its own militia. It's been involved in a lot of violence against gypsies The sort of thing that makes you glad to be British. We have the BNP, but they're pussycats compared with that. And this party, Jobbik, which has had 30% of the vote in the last European Union elections, coming to the village. They'd recently visited a nearby village, and there had been a riot, and it had ended up with quite a bit of property damage and 100 gypsies arrested. So the police chief very sensibly wanted to try and get a dialogue with what they knew was something of a local gypsy leadership, which they knew was likely to be more reasonable and so on. A meeting was arranged with the police chief, the mayor of the village, and the local gypsies. It was horrific. It was awful. It's quite interesting, for a start, that the gypsies that our friends have been working with were very measured and they're putting their point of view quite strongly, but, you know, quite reasonably. But, you know, the others, absolutely wild, shouting, "Hitler, Hitler, Hitler." And mutual incomprehension, the authorities didn't sort of display sympathy, they didn't sort of engage in some sort of dialogue which would have made the gypsies feel that they would have had some protection. It was just a sort of classic, miscommunication. And I've seen a lot of bad things in India, but there's something about it being in Europe that makes it more kind of pinching. The conditions people live in, it's terrible. And afterwards, I was talking to our mitrans, and I said, "Well, it's strange that there are." Oh no, one of them said something. "Well, what's Buddhism got to do with this?" So I said, "Well, as it happens, there are a number of suttas in which the Buddha gives an analysis of social strife." So they were very interested and wanted to hear that. And I, as I say, dusted off a sutta that I'd looked at a long time before and presented it to them. And because, you know, some of the people I was presenting to are really very poorly educated indeed, many of the people that our friends are working with don't really know where Hungary is. They don't know their own country. They don't know where it stands in relation to Romania or Germany or whatever. They just have a very, very limited view of the world. So they're not well educated. It doesn't, of course, mean they're not intelligent. Some are extremely bright. Something I've learnt in India, that intelligence and education don't always go together. You get some very, very highly educated people who are frankly stupid, and you get some very, very uneducated people who are extremely intelligent. And I see that a lot amongst our friends there. So I had to do what I'm very used to doing in India, but I had to do it even more, which is get to the heart of the matter. And the sutra is quite complex. It's got sort of chains within chains. It's not an exactly straightforward presentation, so I had to sort of boil it down. And as always, in doing that, who gained most from it? Me. I learned more from it than I'm sure they did, although they were very interested and I think quite impressed in a way that their situation was clearly sort of analysed, you know, 2,500 years ago. So what I'm going to present you is an epitomised version of that sutta, which in the first place shows how disharmony arises, or in the words of the sutta, how the taking up of stick and sword, quarrels, disputes, arguments, bad words, and general kerfuffle, to use a full Pali term, how they come about. But on the way, I think it explains our quarrels with each other. Even probably here in the North London Buddhist Centre, you have your quarrels, I don't know. But it also gives us a bit of an insight into what goes on in our own minds, which is particularly applicable in meditation, which I think gives us some quite valuable, a sort of model for thinking about what goes on very often in our own meditation. So I'll take you through it and then try and draw some morals from it. So the nidana chain, you're familiar with nidana chains, you know, the outside of the wheel of life, the 12 nidanas. It's actually a sequence that you get in different combinations in quite a number of different places. And there are three suttas which do roughly the same analysis as this, which look at the way in which, from our basic experience, we get into dispute and strife and trouble. So the sutta begins with, or rather the nidana chain begins with a triad. It begins with sensation, feeling, and interpretation. For those of you who know your Pali and Sanskrit, sensation is sparsha, or phasa. Feeling is vedana, and interpretation is samya or samya. So you're familiar with that from the 12 nidanas. You get sparsha, vedana. You don't get samya in that sequence, but it comes in earlier, in fact. But here it's dealt with as a subsequent to feeling. Of course, you get it in the five skandhas, which again some of you will be familiar with, the sort of basic ingredients of experience. So first of all, we come into sensory contact with the world. Our senses engage with the world around us, which produces impressions, sensory impressions. To begin with, those sensory impressions are more or less mechanical, you might say. It's the interaction of the organ, the object in consciousness. But very, very quickly, mixed up with that primary identification of an object, that primary sensing of an object, or data, let's say that, sensing of data, is a feeling. That is a feeling of pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain. So, according to Buddhist theory, psychological theory, all our sensory input has some hedonic tone. It's either pleasurable or painful or somewhere in the middle, a bit neutral. But to sense is to have a pleasure-pain response, even if it's a very dull one. Which is quite significant, quite important, because often we're not aware of that. But it's impinging on us. Our sensory, the feeling response to our sensing is present to us, but largely unconscious, not made conscious. And it can often lead to responses without you really being aware of it. So it's the sort of thing where you see somebody, and for various reasons, you just take a dislike to them. And you can't put your finger on it. Maybe nobody else does this. But it's almost immediate, automatic, it's visceral, as you would say. You just immediately know that you dislike or like. Well, you don't even know you do it, you just do it. And that can then determine your interaction with them, the way you talk to them, the way they then respond to you, and then the way you respond to them. So, but to everything, you know, the floor has some sort of impact on you. You either like it or you don't like it, or you couldn't care less, and so on. Every element of our sensory experience has some hedonic response, and a neutral response is considered a response. It's a sort of non-response, if you like, but that non-response has a consequence. It can lead to a sort of dullness. Anyway, we won't go further there. So what happens then? You take in information, you have an immediate response to it, and then you identify it. Of course, it's not nice and neat and sequential as I'm putting it, but in principle it's like this. So then you say floor, ceiling, light, what's her name? I should have met her. etc. Samya means interpretation, basic identification of the elements of your experience as a this or that, the applying of a label to them, and of course simultaneously the placing of them in a pattern of memory, and so on. All of this is at a very, very basic level here. It's what I call primary reality, primary experience, where you're just taking things in, you're just in a very ordinary way, very commonplace way, identifying things within your experience. Basic experience, what is, in the most ordinary sense. But of course, the feeling that's present in your experience gives it a charge. You want to keep having the pleasurable experience, and you want to know how to get it again in the future. You want to end the painful experience, and you want to know how to avoid it in the future. And that the neutral experience, well, you sort of want to liven it up, if you like. You want to engage a bit more. Neutral experience is sort of boring, I suppose you could say. So that there's a almost instinctual, well, there is an instinctual response to the pleasure and pain content of our experience. A kind of charge. And, we're human beings, which means that we have a self-conscious intelligence. We have the ability to use reflection to deal with our experience and work out how to continue with the pleasurable, avoid the painful, get the pleasurable in the future, avoid the pleasure, the painful in the future, etc. So the distinctive human advance, evolutionary terms, is the ability to identify ourselves and to reflect on our experience with the aim of avoiding pleasure, no?
Getting pleasure
and avoiding pain, etc. So I call it thinking here. The Pali word is vitakka or vitarka, which some of you will be familiar with from the description of the dhyanas. The first dhyana has vitakka vichara in it. Come back to that. So a basic reflection, a taking your experience, standing slightly separate from it, and using thoughts, concepts, to try to resolve it in the direction that you want. But what happens usually then is if there's any substantial charge behind it, it gets out of hand. It begins to, well, the word in Pali is papancha or prapancha, which means to spread out. It's sometimes translated as proliferates. So the initial experience, which is quite simple in a way, then gets reflected upon in the light of previous experience, memories, culture comes into it, the language that you're using to some extent has connections and associations, underlying tendencies that you've got, which go very, very deep. Some of them go right down to basic greed, hatred, and delusion. Some of it which is more personal, unconscious. They get caught up in this reflection on your experience. It spreads out. It connects with previous experience. Ah, it was like that before. Or he or she was like that before. They're connected with them. That's why that. So a whole sort of kind of proliferating, complicating, spreading out of thought takes place, which tries to find a way of explaining and therefore dealing with the charge that's in the initial experience. And that proliferation of thought then solidifies. It solidifies into a sort of system which provides a body of explanation and a sort of project for action. That can be highly personal. You know the sort of thing, something's bothered you, somebody's said something to you, you sit down to meditate and your mind goes to work. Often you can't do anything about it, it just sort of goes to work. And you start thinking about this, you start thinking about that, old sores get reopened, to take a horrible one. You end up with a sort of a kind of resolution, which is basically a manifesto, a project, a plan of what to do. You know, I'm going to say this to him or her. I'm not going to, etc. So you have a sort of complete pattern of exploration that excuses you, that avoids you having to sort of take responsibility, which provides you with an explanation of why they behave like that, and which gives you a course of action to deal with it. So it can be highly personal in that way. It can be group social, you know, a group of people explain their common experience in similar terms. It can be cultural, so it can be on a very large scale. You know, whole societies are built on patterns of proliferation that explain things. I've just been researching the Shia in modern Iran and Iraq, and just looking at the way they were trying to use their whole historic doctrine, theology, and explanation of history to explain what was happening to them now, where the Americans fitted in. And the British too, little poodle, one on the side, and trying to validate their own preferred course of action in the light of that explanation. Horrific. Again, you could see with the Jobbik members, the fascists in Hungary, the way in which their experience of the collapse of communism, with suddenly the Hungarian economy, which was one of the best of the Eastern Bloc, couldn't stand up to Western competition. Whole swathes of industry just disappeared. I've seen it going through northern Hungary, you just see, probably the same in Romania, you just see coal mines empty, steelworks empty, factories just closed, nothing. Huge unemployment. Whereas, you know, for all its vices, Hungarian communism at least had provided full employment. Gypsies were fully employed. Suddenly gone. So deep insecurity. Then a deep sense of humiliation. Hungary is a terrible history of 400 years of being trampled on here, there, and everywhere. Done their own bit of trampling, but that's another matter. So a sense of humiliation as a human being, as a nation, and a seeking for explanations of what's happening in terms of who's responsible. Try the Jews, but there are not so many of them left, and Gypsies are an easier target, and so on. So you build up a whole political agenda, social political agenda, which helps to explain what is actually a quite personal experience, albeit one shared by a large number of people, which then forms into a program, a political program in this case. I won't go into what it means, but it's pretty horrible. So you've constructed an interpretive framework, either on a small scale, on a moment-by-moment scale, or a day-by-day scale, or on a sort of macrocosmic scale, a a shared common explanation, which is embodied in language, in structures of authority, in social structures and so forth. That then itself orders new experience. So the things that you now experience are filtered through the construction that you built out of your initial thought proliferation and so on. So you build what I've called a secondary reality, which deals with the experience of the primary experience in terms of an explanatory model, which is mostly artificial, mostly constructed, and which of course comes into conflict with other people's constructed realities. So, in the case that I was talking about in Northern Hungary, Gypsies had their own constructed reality, and I heard them doing it while I was talking, obviously. The two then come into conflict, and you get, there'll be murders and violence, bloodshed, further problems for all parties. You can see that on that scale of two groups within a single society. You can see it within your own immediate family or personal environment, that you've got a different construction of reality which then conflicts with somebody else's construction of reality. You can see what happens on a grand scale, a global scale. You can see what's happening in the Middle East as these constructions of reality which just cannot but conflict. One of the things that's come out of my recent reading is the extraordinary failure of the American administration to recognise the reality of Iraq when they went in, and failing to plan for it. A naive belief that democracy and shopping were enough to save the world. And not realising that they were dealing with a tribal society with a very powerful religious belief, which is a strong supporter of violence under certain circumstances, which is built, Shiism is built upon martyrdom. So this complete mismatch. The Americans and British went in believing that the benefits of liberal market economy and democratic political system would generate a new Iraq overnight. And it's completely wrong. The situation in Iraq is awful, far worse than we're allowed to hear from what I've been reading. So you can see it on that scale. I've just read a history of the three monarchs who were, as it were, involved in the First World War, the King George V, Kaiser Wilhelm, and Tsar Nicholas, and their personal interpretations of their respective positions in as rulers and of each other. That was a strong factor in the First World War. Wilhelm's relationship with his mother, who was English, had a lot to do with the First World War. Mothers. Terrible things. The system of a moving from primary experience to a construction of that experience in terms of patterns of interpretation that move steadily away from the primary experience and which end up with a sort of constructive lens which then distorts what you see. So that, for instance, a Jobbik member in Hungary, when he sees a gypsy, will see a threat. They will move in a particular way which communicates anxiety or hatred or contempt, so the gypsy starts to play up to that. And I've seen it. And vice versa. Our constructions then shape reality. because the Americans had a particular view, the British and Americans had a particular view, possibly the British out of it, when they went into Iraq, they shaped the experience of the Shia. The Shia then responded in a particular way. Of course, there's another whole story with the Sunnis and then the Kurds and so on. So discharge, disharmony, violence, conflict, disaster. So what this then tells us is that the problem starts here. The problem starts when we allow our thinking to get out of control. You probably get some experience of this, especially when you start to meditate or to try to apply mindfulness. You see that something bugs you. And when you sit to meditate, it's very difficult to stop it getting into your brain, getting into your mind. And sometimes, I mean, usually it's out of control before you've even seen it. But sometimes you can see that it's getting out of control. I had a very strong experience of this. I did a long solitary, I remember mentioning that last time I was here. So there's no outside stimulus, really. There's only memories. I mean, there's a lot of sheep, but they're pretty harmless on the whole. And what I'd notice is I'd remember something that had happened to me, something that somebody had done to me, a bad, awful thing. And then I'd sort of imagine a conversation with them. And I'd imagine what they would say to me. And then I would get upset about what I'd imagined that they were going to say to me. Am I the only person who does this sort of thing? you can even get to a point where you're actually accusing the other person of a certain attitude which you've simply proliferated into existence. They haven't had a chance yet, poor dears, to fling at you. So you can sometimes see yourself sort of building patterns of proliferation which then affect the way you relate to people. That's why sometimes you get a sort of miracle, don't you, when you manage to generate metta towards an enemy, and next time you see them, they behave differently towards you. It's, you know, maybe your directing metta to them does affect them. I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that you are approaching them in a different way, so they respond in a different way. You know, so our proliferation creates self-fulfilling prophecies. And it's something I think is very important to learn to notice in one's own mental activity. You notice a lot in conversation that you're talking about something which perhaps is a problem or something that you like, and you can notice, if you listen, you can usually notice it better with other people. The sort of thinking gets less and less realistic. It moves away from what actually is and becomes more and more constructive and interpretive. Some people are very, very good at it and can build very, very sophisticated architectures, cathedrals of interpretation. Some people it's more obvious, more clunky. But it comes to the same thing. It's what in Buddhism we call views, interpretive structures, which are not a direct reflection on reality, which are a construction of reality for purposes of self-preservation, as it were, but very inefficient. So the problem is here. The point at which you're engaging with the primary experience gets out of hand. A lot of what we need to do in meditation, I think, is learn to get a grip on it, to stop it from happening too soon. Well, to stop it happening at all. To stop it, to notice it happening, and if you can, rein it in. And the primary antidote is to come back to basic experience. When you find yourself getting out of control in that sort of way, you come back to those things that are beyond doubt. In other words, touch, sensation, even, you know, floor, ceiling. Just to come back to those elements of your experience which are primary, without too much sort of not put too fine a point upon it. You could even question interpretation: is it, when is a table, and when is it a floor for dancing on? If you've had too much to drink, but you know, just sort of primary identification. In other words, mindfulness. So what we call mindfulness is, to some extent, learning to come back to and stay with absolutely basic experience, particularly mindfulness in the form of body mindfulness, kaya nupassana, just being aware of your basic sensations. And you'll find if you're sort of off on that track, coming back to your basic awareness does sort of diffuse the trend or tendency. It brings you back to something much more solid, much more real. Because the problem with this is constructive. It has a sort of quasi-reality, what I call a secondary reality. But yes, it's abstracted. It's abstracted from your direct experience. So you come back to your direct experience. Your vitakka, your thinking, directs you back to your primary experience. So you sort of tell yourself, well, just watch your sensations. Just watch your breathing. Just see what your immediate feeling is. So vitakka there, instead of proliferating, takes you back to what's really going on. Vitakka also, it's an intelligent appraisal, gives you a possibility of an intelligent appraisal of how to act. After all, you are in a situation. You know, you are unemployed, you are threatened by a fascist organisation or whatever. So you need to act. You can't just sort of say, oh, it doesn't exist. You have to act, but you need to act in a way that's going to be of the greatest possible benefit to you, and indeed the greatest possible benefit to everybody. In other words, you need to introduce sila. Reflection on the situation in terms of what actions will provide the greatest degree of benefit to the greatest number, starting with yourself. So your thinking, instead of zooming off into proliferation, reflects on the situation with a helpful intention, with the intention of providing the best possible solution. Think the thinking faculty, a distinctive human faculty, first of all, yes, it brings us back to primary reality. Secondly, it allows us to choose a skillful course of action. It also takes us into a deeper experience of what is actually going on. A deeper experience of what's going on through meditation, through aesthetic exploration, so that yes, it's you know, these primary sensations and feelings and interpretations, but they're given greater richness and depth through the turning back of our reflection upon that experience and a deepening of sensitivity to it. Also, of course, thinking has the function of reflecting on the real nature of that experience. In other words, of prajna or vipassana, of reflecting what it really means to sense, what the nature of the objects that we're sensing is. They're impermanent, they're devoid of substantial existence. So that, if you like, you've got a cycle, a wheel, but you've got also an implicit spiral. By breaking the chain here, by not allowing thinking to go on through proliferation, but getting your thinking faculty to bring you back to mindfulness, getting your thinking to enrich, think about the most skillful action possible within that situation, by using your thinking to enrich your experience, and by using your thinking to discern its real significance, its deeper meaning. you have a spiral emerging at this point. So I've skipped you through it. There's a lot in there, but I've given you at least the outline of the pattern, and I'd be interested for a few minutes to see if there's anything that anybody wants to ask or comment or disagree with or quarrel with, but remembering not to proliferate and quarrel.
I just wanted to tell you that I do the same thing you did.
Oh, good, thank you.
A creation of arguments.
Yeah, yeah, and then argue. Yeah, thanks for that reassurance.
You think, why did I do that?
Yeah. Why are you getting upset? They haven't actually done it.
But the emotion's just as real as
Yeah.
I do it too.
It's confession time.
Now I've got that out of the way, could you just remind us of the name of the sutra again?
It's the Mudupindala Sutta, and it's usually translated as the honey ball.
Ball?
Ball, yes. Okay. A ball of honey. I think of it as paklava. But I like paklava. So it's a sweet made of honey. Like, so at the end of the sutta, somebody says, oh, that was a wonderful sutta. It really tasted so sweet, and things. So everybody said, well, we'll call it that, etc.
It would be, if you don't mind me just asking one other question, it would be interesting to know how our friends in Hungary actually responded to that.
Oh.
And was there an outcome?
Well, I couldn't say that. In a way, what I'm still at the stage of sort of showing people that the Dhamma actually is relevant to them. But the outcome that I noticed was that some people were able to use that to defuse other people's proliferation. So before, you know, somebody said, it's been reported that somebody who works at the police station has said that the police are colluding with Jopik to come and burn our school down. So somebody said, wait a minute, look, that's up here somewhere. particularly as one of you said, rumour. What's the evidence? What's the facts? Mm. So some people got it and sort of realised what it was getting at. Others didn't, clearly, but some got it, and I'm sure it will help them. But really, at the moment, we're at the sort of stage of learning that the Dhamma is relevant to desperately poor, marginalised people. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, I've got a lot of experience of that being the case in India. But I was impressed myself at the power of the sutta to talk about their experience. It's something I've always felt we need to do, is to address what's really going on for people. So, for instance, I remember arriving in Valencia just after the Madrid bombings. And, I started to talk, and after a bit I wrote, I can't go on without saying something intelligent about that. I gave a talk in India on the night after the Bombay terrorist attacks took place. So I gave a talk a bit along these lines on the causes of violence and what we can do about it. And what one's response to the horror in the world. So I think it's very, very important to sort of take the issues that are really hot for people. So that's what I tried to do in that situation. And it did. I won't say it meant that they all were able to deal with it, but it made quite a big difference to some. And they're getting more and more of an idea of just how potent the Dhamma is, as opposed to Jesus Christ. That's another story.
It brings us back, doesn't it, to what Buddhism is about. And it's quite interesting the way you talk about it. It's kind of bringing thinking in relationship to our sensory experience.
Exactly, yeah.
In that kind of way. Because a lot of people, often we think of that as a lot of people come to the bathroom and say, it's not, it's trying to stop thinking.
Exactly, yeah.
And also, but it's actually that real kind of putting together, isn't it, of our reflective nature in relationship to our experience.
Yeah.
And I mean, somehow, I don't know, I just feel kind of fascinated by it.
Well, that I mean, you know, what I said about the taka taking you back to smriti and meditation and so forth is my own. Well, it is there in the scriptures, but it's not worked out in those terms. But it's, to me, the only place where you find a kind of a way of seeing the positive value of thinking. And what people want to stop is proliferation. So when they want to stop thinking, what they really mean, or they should mean, is they want to stop proliferating. This sort of compulsive spreading out of thought, which is very strongly emotionally driven. What is called in the scriptures drishti, or views, ditti.
But what I'm thinking about, I suppose, is sadhana practice, where actually you're thinking that you're actually doing, you're bringing yourself closer to your sensation.
Yeah.
So in a way, there's a proliferation there too, because it's a deepening and a broadening out in a kind of way, but in a very different way than that is an alienation of yourself from yourself in a way.
I suppose it seems to me that the issue is that proliferation abstracts you from the situation, alienates you. And it creates increasingly a false veneer or miasma on top of experience. Whereas vitakka, properly used, as within meditation, it directs you to the deeper qualities and the richer qualities of the experience. Of experience. I think this is what is very distinctive about Buddhism. That it has a very, very deep view of the possibilities of human experience, but it refuses to abstract them beyond a certain point.
Just a slightly different question. You were saying that the first thing we do is come back to the elements and experience, which we know are real. I don't know if they're your exact words.
Well, it cannot be doubted, I'd say. Yeah.
Beyond doubt. So one way of doing that is to come back to physical experience, which is that quality. Are there other things that we could come back to, elements within our experience, things that we know are true, but aren't maybe just on a physical, sensory level, that can act as a kind of, as a refuge in that moment when we find ourselves proliferating, somewhere else that we can come back to?
Well, traditionally it's said, for instance, that you can come back to the Buddha. So you come back to the Buddha as a the one who has attained transcendence, and that awakens your faith, so that you move away from the false construction of things to something that to the experience of faith, a faith in the possibilities within reality. So that would be another way of thinking about it. It's not quite so easy to fit into the interpretive framework that I've given, but yes, you could think in those terms. But traditionally, again, you can use any of the four satipatthanas. So you can use body awareness, you can use awareness of feeling, you can use awareness of the condition of your mind, of citta, or you can use a reflection on the quality and nature of your experience in the light of the Dhamma. So you could use any of those things which direct you back to what is real. In a sense, you could say the Buddha, reflection on the Buddha, directs you back to what is real, because the Buddha is the one who sees what is real. But I think that probably a strong tendency to proliferation is needs to be accompanied, at least to some extent, by kayam smriti, coming back to the body. I think that probably is for most people at least a quite strong element of it. You may need to remember the Buddha in order to motivate yourself to do it. Because, frankly, it's not that interesting if you're not that type. senses are always the last thing I refer to. There's a good theory, I'll go for that.
Mm. Yeah. It strikes me that the word proliferation, I'm not what that means, but perhaps it could be, it's graspy, isn't it?
Well, there's certainly a grasping element in it, yeah.
It's a compulsive, because the word proliferation could just mean rich, couldn't it?
Yes, I see what you mean, yeah. Yeah, no, it's always used in a negative sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a word that's much debated, and you know there are various translations given.
But that's a traditional word to use at that point.
Yeah. Both in it's used in Mahayana as well. In Nagarjuna uses it, especially in the form of nisprapancha, which is equivalent to shunyata.
But it does overlap with. It's a compulsive grasping.
Yeah.
Pushing and pulling. As opposed to leaving it there.
Yeah.
Letting it be what it is.
Yeah. In the nidana chain, we're more familiar with. You remember, you move from vedana to trishna, and from trishna to upadana. Am I right? Yes. Under the heading of craving and of grasping, one of the things you grasp onto are drishti, views. So you could say that is a sort of an underlying interpretive structure for proliferation. There are two sides to it. One is the tendency to go looking, if you see what I mean. You're searching for a solution to a problem that's been stated here. And your mind goes looking within the rag bag of its memories and thoughts and so forth, and in what it's reading and culture and so on. You're looking. So the proliferative tendency is, first of all, a sort of exploratory, but not in a very healthy way, because it's driven by a strong reaction to feeling. It then solidifies, really, what I call construction, strictly as papancha sanya sankha, which means a construction of proliferation and adding together, adding up of proliferation into a sort of a clunk, that a system that you then grasp onto. So do you see what I mean? The proliferation initially is the search for a solution, which gets out of hand, and it's not a careful sort of controlled inquiry. It's an instinctive driven process, which again you can see so easily as your mind drifts. And then once you arrive at some sort of solution, apparent solution, then there's a clinging. Sometimes I notice it, there's a sort of that's what it is. And that the immediate sense is of relief. So that, for instance, you're to take the negative example, you're thinking about somebody who's upset you. And you're going searching for you need to explain your own upset to yourself. You need to explain why they've done it. And you need to find a way of dealing with it. And there's a certain point you go, that's what it was. That's what I'm going to do. And you feel some sort of relief. You feel some relief from the pressure, as it were. And you have a sort of temporary sense of, I've solved it. And you're quite then attached to that. And difficult then sometimes to shift that.
I think I sometimes confuse proliferation with intuition. I think sometimes I do things I know. I do put things together. I do have the why. Mm. And sometimes I'm right.
Sure.
But sometimes I'm wrong. Mm. I think, you know, sometimes it's intuition, sometimes it's just not a very good idea. I just put it together wrongly.
But isn't it just, I was just thinking the same.
So So I wonder if for either of them, whether it's proliferation or intuition, maybe for both of them, there's a benefit in sort of going back to the what you've called the primary to check them out.
Well, it depends what intuition. You know, it's not a neutral faculty, as it were. So what is the interest behind the intuition? Why is the intuition going that way? Well, you may be right that they're all out to get you. You may be right that, they're this, that, or the other. Your intuition may be accurate, but what's the motive behind that? So that even the intuition can be part of a proliferative process, which ends up with a construction. I'm very, very familiar with this in India because it's a low-trust society, with the legacy of caste, and people constantly know other people's motives. And not infrequently, they're right. But the knowing of other people's motives and the building up of the systems of dealing with that interpretation are not at all helpful. So then the intuition can be simply a part of the process of constructing a program, a manifesto, a platform to deal with the exciting cause.
Isn't it just back down to skillful thinking? Because I was going to say that I can get the moment and the relief when I've thought skillfully. So isn't it just using intuition for the good or the bad, and it's how you use it.
That would be the point here, wouldn't it? That you need to check the motivation, and that almost always is going to involve checking out what's at the bottom of it all.
I think you know the difference. One way or the other.
You may do.
I think you sort of know the more peaceful one. Yeah. That's what I've got to do, but it's actually the more skillful. Yeah.
I'm afraid I can only say, speak for yourself, my dear. I think I sometimes convince myself that it's an intuition when it's just a prejudice, if you see what I mean. Do you see what I mean? You may have a very accurate intuition.
No, I'm not saying always. I'm just saying I think there are quite often times when you do know when you're getting it right. You've got a better feeling around it.
Well, of course, the key thing is the feeling, isn't it? It's the motivation. Is it a skillful motivation or not? What do you do with your intuition or your induction, that there's bad motives coming at you, as it were? What do you do with that? How do you feel about it?
You do have a point, because, I mean, the extremist will say, yes, it's a feeling, do you know what I mean? That's keeping asking the question, isn't it? Or keeping flexible, reassessing, that's the point.
Well, what do we really know? I mean, that's quite an important question.
Doesn't the Buddha say something about intuition being like a blind elephant? Somewhere it's very, very big and very, very powerful and can achieve a lot, but it can't necessarily see where it goes. But reason has like a small house or something like that. That kind of, it can see very clearly, but doesn't necessarily understand the power behind it. Have you come across that somewhere?
No, that's all right. Sounds good. I can't think what the Pali for intuition would be.
If it's really intuition, isn't real intuition defined by being in line with reality somehow, whereas proliferation...
Intuition is such a slippery word, isn't it?
I
sort of feel a little uneasy about the trend of the word, if you see what I mean. What do we mean by intuition? This means such different things. It's a sort of grasping of something as a whole. That was Jung's use of it, wasn't it? It's the seeing of the pattern of things. But sometimes it's used for a kind of a guess at what's going on or whatever. Sometimes it's even a sort of almost extrasensory reaching out to what's going on.
It's legitimately not rational, isn't it? It's legitimately not rational intuition.
Yes, that's right.
That's the definition, isn't it?
It's arriving at a judgment about things by non-rational means. I think that's the...
As a ground of faith, it needs to be in combination with experience and reason.
Yes, yes.
Otherwise, sense, it doesn't.
Yeah.
When legitimize each other in a sense when they're in alignment.
Yeah. And obviously, there's a, in the progress of faith, there's a point at which you can utterly rely on your intuition. Mm. It's not really intuition, actually. I think it's I don't know if that's the word that Bhante uses, but I think it's a response from Bhante talks about it. What is it? Faith is a response of what is ultimate in you to what is ultimate in the universe. There's a point at which you can rely on that completely, presumably the point where you've understood the Dhamma deeply enough. But I think we're talking more here about a non-rational judgment about situations or conclusion about things. And I think you're right, some people have that sort of capacity, but it should be checked with other faculties. And you need to be looking at the spin that you're giving it. Because it can become part of a proliferative process which ends up with a constructive program. And to use intelligence to bring you back. There's a lot in the model, but I've sort of set it all out for you, and you can work with it if you want to, if you have an intuitive feeling for it.